A lot of this book is about me, and I think we'll be discussing that maybe. And the two excerpts that I'm going to be reading reflect that. This one is called Permission to Publish. Through the following two academic years after my Kollel year, and especially as I continued to come to the yeshiva when I could and from time to time take notes, I became more and more confident that there was indeed a book hidden in those notes. One day while crossing the arts quad at Cornell, I realized, but I'll have to ask the Rosh Yeshiva's permission first. It took me a few more months to gather the courage and then another few weeks to find the opportunity. How was I to broach this question with a man whose authority was unquestioned and to whom, although I had sat in his shir for a few years, I had hardly said more than good Shabbos? I practiced my explanation in my head. When I rehearsed it to a friend who's an academic Talmudist over dinner in Ithaca one evening, he said, "You got me when you told me it has to do with your parnassa," meaning your livelihood. To be sure, I had plenty of clues that what it takes to earn an honest living played a considerable role in a number of the Rosh Yeshiva's dicta and of his father's rulings as well. One day in May 2014, I missed a siyum celebrating the group's completion of a chapter in the Gemara. My friend Asher filled me in on some of the good ones, lines I'd missed. I finally asked him a question I'd been embarrassed to ask for far too long. What about paintball? Is it mutter, permitted, or usser, forbidden? And he, the Rosh Yeshiva, said that since there's a risk that you'll get bloodied or bruised, and there's no other benefit from it, it's forbidden. Once someone asked him about a Shomer Shabbos boxer, and he said, well, he's doing it for a living. As to baseball, he says the kids are used to doing it already, and they get their excess energy out that way. So I knew it was important to explain how publishing a book about the yeshiva was linked to how I earn my living. My notes from December 17th, 2014 read, Rebbe comes in and my heart races because after shir, I'm planning to ask his permission to write a book about the Beis Medrash. But I didn't get to ask him that day and had to wait almost a week. Here's what I wrote about the day I finally got to ask him for permission to write a book about MTJ. A young couple from Lakewood with a baby are waiting with me. They have an appointment with the Rosh Yeshiva at 12:30. I try to make the baby smile without inappropriately looking at the woman. Right now, I'm betting he'll say no, but I didn't get to finish writing that sentence because the young couple came out and I had my chance to go in. I stand for a moment by the open door waiting for him to finish perusing a document, sign it, and look up. I begin the speech I've rehearsed many times by now, sometimes to myself and sometimes live. Maybe the Rebbe knows that I spent a couple of years learning here in the 80s. It's been a great privilege and pleasure to be able to spend time learning here the last few years. Of course, I have to work most of the time, but I'm fortunate to have a job that gives me a lot of free time. I had a leave from work coming up in 2012, and Rabbi Brody suggested, why don't you go to the Rosh Yeshiva's shir? I've been very happy, and I hope to keep learning here for many years. I think the Rebbe knows that I teach and write about Jewish communities for a living. I wrote my dissertation, a book about Polish Jews in Paris, and I've written a book about my shul here on the Lower East Side. Now, I would very much like to write a book about the Beis Medrash. And the Rebbe replied, why not? Well, in my many imaginings of this conversation, that was one response I thought he might possibly make. I went on to promise to disguise as much as I could, although I had to admit I wouldn't be able to disguise the place itself because it's unique. That's a good idea, he responded. That way you'll have the ruchnius, the spirit, without the gashmius, the matter. But he had one more question. I don't understand what it has to do with Parnassa. So I explained, it's certainly not because you make money from the books. Rather, you write a dissertation to get a PhD. If you're lucky, you get a job. You write a book to get tenure and another to become a full professor. Quickly, I went on to explain that at my stage, I wouldn't lose my job if I didn't publish another book, but it's an expected part of doing the job in an honorable fashion. He shook my hand with the Yiddish words, Zol zayn mit hatzlacha, may your venture be successful. I guess it isn't as big a deal to him as it is to me, but as I had started writing before I went on into his office, I had myself thinking he certainly would say no. And if he had, that would have been an end to it. In this respect, to be sure, he is my rabbi. And then the very last sort of coda chapter is called Learning and the Time of the Dream. The time of the dream, I'll say, is definitely intended to be an allusion for anthropologists to the Australian notion of the dream time. And without being too heavy-handed about it, sometimes I get the feeling, not of timelessness, I struggle with this, but that when people are sitting and learning full time, they're in a different temporality than the workaday world. Dreams often seem to afford almost infinite time for exploration. And perhaps one of my friend Nassano's remarkable gifts is the ability to extend time or to defy the shackles of quantified linear time. This comes through, for example, in his way of making the old new, as when he was talking to me about the biblical story of Hannah and Peninnah and called them Grace and Pearl, or his habit of referring to the medieval commentator and decisor, Rabbeinu Tam, as Rabbi Perfect. All of these are, of course, just literal translations of the Hebrew names, but somehow the English versions, rather than stripping them of Jewish particularity, here bring them closer to our own world and time. In the waking world, we are either here or there, or someplace in between. Writing the date in my notebook toward the end of our one winter break, I thought of the days I had available to learn Torah slipping away. I was reminded of a story I read many years ago about Anshul Rothschild, the founder of the family banking house. It's said that when he was busy in his office, he would hire an old Jewish scholar to sit in an anteroom and learn, only interrupting his studies to come out once an hour into the office and say, "It's 1 o'clock, Reb Anshul. It's 2 o'clock, Reb Anshul." I've always understood from that anecdote that Anshul Rothschild meant thereby to remind himself that no matter how much wealth he might be accumulating, every hour he spent in his office was an hour lost to Torah. My friend Rabbi Weiss gently conveyed a similar message to me when he learned that my kollel year was about up and I was planning to return to North Carolina to resume my university teaching. A few times toward the end of December, he looked at me and said, a bit sadly, "Not much time, Professor." And he repeated, as he said many times over the year, "You should get a job in New York. You should stay with us." The table where I study with my friends is near the big window, and Yisrael Rubin got up to shut it properly. "It got so cold all of a sudden," somebody said. I said that I like the cold. I'm worried about global warming, and the cold reassures me. "Well," Yisrael Rubin said, "you're from Minneapolis, Cincinnati, someplace like that, right?" I didn't even realize he was talking to me at first, but when I did, I corrected him. "North Carolina. Ah, that's why you're worried. You'll get flooded there." Rabbi Weiss, sitting next to us, though not really joining us in the preparation for the shiur, quietly said, "See, I told you, you should stay in New York." I never got even that kind of gentle pressure from my friend Asher Stoller. Instead, when I got up to say goodbye to everyone for the time being and bemoan that I had to go to work, Asher said, "The truth is, for somebody who works, you probably spend more time in the Beis Medrash than anybody else." Still, I felt the impending loss, and somehow I wanted a blessing before I left. I mentioned to Rabbi Cantor that I'd like to speak to him after Mincha. I asked him to have me in mind while I'm away, that I should continue to learn and that my intentions in learning should improve. He took my request very seriously, first asking for my Hebrew name, and that of my father and mother. Anytime you're praying for something, not just when you're sick, he said, you should use the mother's name. I learned it from a pasuk, and I told Reb Moshe, and he liked it very much. Your servant, the son of your maidservant. Then he took my hand in his, looked intently into my eyes, and blessed me that Hashem should make you the biggest Talmud Chacham that he wants you to become. He had said the same thing about a year earlier, and the first time it sounded a bit overly pious to me, but this time it sounded like a pure gift, the most heartfelt blessing I've ever received, an almost unbearably intimate moment. Meanwhile, I'm often in between. One night in early December 2014, I finished my last duty in Ithaca for the semester, a dinner for a job candidate. I had originally been planning to drive to New York the following day, but the weather in between New York City and Ithaca the next morning sounded so awful that I got in the car and drove back at night, arriving at almost 2 a.m. I usually avoid driving that late at night, but I just told myself that driving and concentrating on it was what I was going to do for the next 4 hours. For more than half the trip until I'd made it past Scranton, I didn't even turn on the radio. An odometer, along with knowing how many miles I have to drive, helps the hours go by minute, a mile doesn't take so long and it's measurable. The trick is not to fall into a trance. I thought of the trip both because it made it possible for me to be in yeshiva in time for preparation and shiur the next day, and because that kind of relaxed focus, hard enough to achieve at any time, but necessary for safe driving, especially at night, struck me as analogous to the kind of concentration needed for learning it. Yet, during shiur the next morning, I dozed off and saw nighttime highway before my eyes.
Well, thank you. First of all, I want to thank Professor Starr for her kind introduction and also for organizing this. And then I also want to thank Jonathan for inviting me to ask him some questions and to share a few thoughts about his book. It's really an honor for me, really a great honor that he asked me. I'm sure many of you, and there's actually more than 100 participants according to the screen in front of me, which is extraordinary, are acquainted with at least some of Jonathan's work. I remember, I think the first thing I read was From a Ruined Garden, which is a book that he did with Jack Kugelmass on excerpts from Yisker Bicher, as well as a really fine introduction of Yisker Bicher being memorial books of towns in Eastern Europe, shtetls that were destroyed during the Holocaust. And it's really a watershed book in a lot of ways. And I really recommend it if you haven't read it already. So what I want to do is first to say a few things about where I think this fits into the history of Jewish ethnography, at least. And then just a couple words about the sort of quality of the book in a general way, and then ask a few questions. So very briefly, in a way, this book strikes me as Jewish ethnography, or at least Jewish ethnography, or ethnography of Eastern European Jews in their original setting of Eastern Europe, and then in what might be described as a diaspora settings, as coming full circle. And the reason I say that is because a number of the early ethnographers, including those who participated with Anske on this expedition that Jonathan mentioned a few minutes ago in the teens of the previous century into the Pale of Settlement, had themselves been yeshiva students. And in fact, that's why they were chosen by Anske to participate in the expedition, because they brought this kind of expertise to their study of Jewish culture on the ground. Many of them were actually desperate to leave the yeshiva. In the questionnaire that Jonathan mentioned, there's tens, if not hundreds, of questions on the yeshiva, different aspects of it. And yet there is a sense in which the trajectory into Jewish ethnography is also a trajectory away from the yeshiva, at least by some of the participants. Another thing that I think about is the fact that this is not about Hasidim or about Hasidic culture, because in more recent Jewish ethnography, at least again focusing on Eastern Europe and its diaspora, of course, there's tons of Jewish ethnography on other areas, Jewish communities in the world, North Africa, you know, Middle East, etc. But in terms of Eastern European Jewish culture, a lot of it has focused on Hasidism or on Hasidic culture and communities. And this is not that. This is about what you would call yeshivish culture, if I wanted to put it into cultural terms, and the central institution of that culture, which is at least the central academic institution, in many ways, arguably the defining institution, which is the yeshiva. Now, there is another book, another landmark book, The World of the Yeshiva by William Helmreich, Olav Shalom, who passed away just a few months ago, actually, of COVID, very sadly. And he may be known to some of you for doing a book, for his book, more recent book, on walking every single block in New York City. 6,000 miles or so it took him. But before that, he published a book called The World of the Yeshiva, which has some relationship to what Jonathan did, but in certain ways, even though they're both about yeshivas, they're extremely different. And maybe Jonathan could speak to some of those differences and maybe commonalities a little bit different. But it is not an institution that has had a lot of attention paid to it, either by historians, although there's some good work in that area, or certainly by ethnographers. In terms of the quality of the book, you've already probably gathered some of it just from the reading. It's extremely charming. I think it's delightfully written. It's very easy to read, very accessible. It's very intimate. I mean, actually, that was the first word. It's funny because the subtitle of The World of the Yeshiva is an intimate portrait, but this is more intimate than Helmreich's book, by far, I would say, or intimate in a different way, for sure. But it's also at the same time informed by this deep knowledge and acquaintance with not only the history of Jewish ethnography and anthropology, but of anthropology more generally. And here, you know, you already heard the allusion to Dreamtime, to this other place in the history of anthropology, to Australian societies and Native Australian societies. And so it's really extraordinary to, on the one hand, move between these intimate registers and then these, you know, highly informed, inflected, and self-aware registers. It's a very self-aware ethnography. Not all of them are, but this one really is in many, many ways. So with that as a, by way of an introduction, I want to start with the first question. And in a way, what I'm going to be doing is parsing the title of the book, and using those as kind of keywords to ask some questions. The first one has to do with the yeshiva, the Masifta Tiferes Yerushalayim, or Jerusalem, MTJ as it's known as well. And for you to, you mentioned that it's unique, in your remarks, Jonathan. Could you provide us with a sense of why it's unique and what is this yeshiva? Why should we care about this particular place?
Some of the reasons why it's unique are the same as the reasons why the Lower East Side has been and to some extent remains a unique Jewish community in North America. The mix of Jews who have passed through there, the the word non-differentiation is coming to my mind, but what I'm trying to point to, at least in the 21st century, is that at MTJ, there isn't a sense of, oh, this is a yeshiva that belongs to this particular group. This is a yeshiva that produces graduates who will marry women from this particular community. It's not a kirov yeshiva, right? It's not aimed at bringing people back into the fold. It's not trying to be the strictest or the purest or the most rigidly orthodox. There are Hasidim there. It's definitely not a Hasidic yeshiva, but there are room. There's room for guys from Brooklyn to come in and study for a few years in Yiddish if they want to. It's a neighbor, it's in a sense, at least the part of the institution that I'm writing about, it's a little bit of a misnomer to call it a yeshiva, because I'm really talking about a Beis Medrash. I'm really talking about, as one of the chapter titles calls it, a big room where men, and only men, come in to study. Some of them are young, unmarried men. Some of them are married men who are going to be doing this for the rest of their life. Some of them are men who are retired and now have the opportunity to do so. Some come in for a couple of hours a week. Some get paid a stipend. Some don't. They learn in singly or in pairs or in small groups that form and then dissolve and then reform. During the period that I'm writing about, the major formal event in the Beis Medrash is the Rosh Hashiva's Shir, but you don't have to go to it in order to be a member of the Kollel. And in fact, he holds his shir in a side room with about 12 or 15 people. And that takes me to another point that's unique about this yeshiva. It's relatively small compared to yeshivas in Lakewood or in Brooklyn or in Muncie. And yet its head is one of the top halachic authorities in the world. So, and a lot of the, what I call, in many ways, a remarkably tolerant spirit of the place, in terms of dress, for example, there's no particular dress code at NCJ. There's a way that most people dress, but you don't have to in order to belong there. And I traced a lot of that to the legacy of our Rosh Yeshiva's father, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and his inclusive sensibilities.
So I wonder if you could continue to kind of fill in the portrait of MTJ by talking about its physical location, and because that's also another way in which it's unique. Right. And you know, you write in the book, there are a number of really evocative passages. You actually read one where you move between places, between Ithaca and New York, but also between the East Village and the Lower East Side, and even just where MTJ is, which is in a very particular place. So I wonder if you could kind of walk us down maybe from the East Village.
Well, that's great. Yeah.
At MTJ, and tell us what you would see. Yeah. and when you arrive, what does it look like? Because it's pretty striking in its own way.
Well, back around 1979, Alyssa Sampson and I managed to talk our way into a building called the Egeloff Towers, which is on the corner of 3rd Street and Avenue A. It's a 12-story building. And at that time, it was the tallest building between it and the Forwards building on East Broadway, yeah, about a mile away. So to get from that building to MTJ, you cross Houston Street, past Russ and Daughters, a little further west on Houston, and you cross what is now at Delancey, the Essex Crossing glossy development. That's pretty new. Continue on for a few more blocks and then turn right onto East Broadway. And MTJ is a sort of neo-Moorish building at 145 East Broadway. When I first went there in the early 80s, the Jewish Lower East Side continued down East Broadway. Feldheim's bookstore was further south, and the Munkacs Talis factory and so forth. But even then, the Lower East Side was shrinking and Chinatown was expanding. So I used to call it almost 40 years ago already, the Yeshiva de Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And more broadly, I'm very careful not to call it the last yeshiva on the Lower East Side, because we don't know what's going to happen. But right now, it's the only yeshiva on the Lower East Side. So it is a major anchor for that very stubbornly persistent Jewish community.
Yeah, and that actually leads me to my next question, which is, how should we see this book and the institution in light of more than a century of Jewish history in the Lower East Side, especially a history which, if you were to look at, you know, the popular renditions and the more scholarly renditions, it doesn't focus on the Orthodox, typically, on the Orthodox community on the Lower East Side. The Lower East Side was much more about, let's say, the Forward or the Forwards Building than it was about MTJ, I would say, and the kind of secular Jewish culture, you know, for example, the Hillman houses, the other houses built by the other co-ops built by unions or inhabited, you know, by many of the garment worker Jewish garment workers and others. So there's something about this institution still standing, and in a way. Well, my question is, how do you see it in relation to that broader history of the Lower East Side,
Jewish Lower East Side? I can think of a couple of books of memoirs of Orthodox life on the Lower East Side earlier in the 20th century. There's one called All for the Boss. There's one called, I don't remember the number, but I'm going to say 152 Sheriff Street, some number of Sheriff Street. But you're right, World of Our Fathers. Irving Howe was a socialist. That was probably the most important thing for him. The Forwards was the biggest newspaper, and it certainly wasn't an Orthodox paper. There was a range. The Tug was a little more conservative, a little more religious, and so forth. Orthodox and Hasidic groups today, even if those congregations had antecedents on the Lower East Side, don't seem to regard the Lower East Side as a particularly significant place of origin for them. So I think that's one reason, which I can't fully explain, but somehow the Lower East Side as an intermediate place gets elided there, whereas for many American Jews, this really is ground zero for their Jewish history. And if yes, then where the family was before that, they say Europe, right? It's kind of a blank. I think that's part of the story. For me personally, my involvement has a lot to do, I think, not with theology or destiny, but with the fact that after Alyssa and I had spent a year in Paris in the early 1980s studying elderly left-wing secular Polish-Jewish immigrants, who were people who deeply impressed me with their wisdom and their stubbornness and their survival skills, but who had been able to pass on very little of their Jewishness to their own children. We came back to the Lower East Side with the conviction that Jewish continuity, a terrible phrase, especially in diaspora, requires some framework of everyday doing of Jewish things and not doing of things that aren't Jewish. Yeah. And we wanted to become more involved in the local Jewish community on the Lower East Side. And what had survived by that point, in the decades after World War II, was almost exclusively the religious institutions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to add that part of the reason this is not so much a picture of the Lower East Side is because it's what survived, and part of the myth of the Lower East Side is that nothing's left there. Usually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask about the doing Jewishness on a daily basis, one aspect of it, which is learning, which is also part of your book title. And one thing that I've always thought, and I know your brother is among the participants, so he can maybe speak to this, not here, but think about it at least, which is that it's always struck me that on the one hand, learning Gemara or learning Talmud, however way you want to put it, is the central activity of Rabbinic Judaism, right? In terms of the scholarly activity. On the other hand, I've always found it to be the most difficult thing to teach students, undergrads at least, at the university, when I've tried to do it. Because the learning and the kind, and that's the learning that you're describing in the book has always struck me as so different from the kind of, from what's going on. I don't know whether it's exactly learning, whether that word is exactly the right verb here, that goes on typically, at least at universities or colleges, both in terms of the subject matter itself and in terms of the way that it happens. Okay. So, I'm curious what it was like for you to move between these two modes, between the academic mode of being a professor at Cornell or earlier in your earlier incarnation at North Carolina, and then learning in the yeshiva or in the Beis Medrash. What were the things that really struck you? Or maybe you disagree with me. That's fine. I mean, you know, there is a continuum.
I think there are real disjunctures and there are continuum. Okay. I think that a lot of the way academic Talmudists study Talmud are the same as the way people in yeshiva study Talmud. They try to figure out what the correct text is. They try to know what the generations of the scholars were. They try to figure out how these two people could have been having a conversation when they lived 150 years apart from each other. And a lot of what I focus on in my book is the places, the ways in which there wasn't so much of a gap. But what struck me and what I write about over and over is the sense of that study in the yeshiva is not aimed at production. You don't have to publish, right? To put it crudely, to stay there. It's about the doing of it. People want to get better. They want to not just sit and study. Yes, they want to learn. They want to know more. But the focus is on the practice of studying together. And it's social in a way that our work in the humanities very, very rarely is. It is inherently social. The norm is to be sitting together, vocalizing the text and arguing about it. And as my friend Tzvi Septimus says, it's always with the Talmud, since it's such a telegraphic document, you're always recreating the text. You're always performing it. You're never just reading it.
Do you think that it changed you, this experience? It changed you, let me make that more pointed. Do you think that it changed you as an anthropologist or as a scholar more generally, the kind of your perspective, how you approach things, the time that you spent learning in the yeshiva, this intense period?
I think honestly, I'm at a stage in my life and my career where I'm less concerned about production, even in my university world, and more concerned, like when I'm teaching a seminar, about really seeing what can happen there in those two hours. I go back to my first year of college. I had a remarkable class at the New School called Values in the Arts and Sciences. And our final assignment was to do a course evaluation. And one of the things I wrote was, things happened in that class, right? So let it be about the moment and the intersection then and the text that we produce together.
So my last question is on the is about being a participant observer. This something that commonly comes up with ethnography. And did you think that that question was any different for this than any, you know, some of your other things that you've done?
It's always somewhat different, but since I'm always present as a Jew studying other Jews or living with them and then writing about them, it presents in slightly different fashion. When I was much younger and in Paris dealing with much older people, I felt myself sometimes a surrogate grandchild. You know, here was the young man who spoke Yiddish and wanted to hear the story in Yiddish. I think that had a lot to do with my access. By the time, or when I'm writing about my synagogue on the Stan Street Shul, I finally decided to just record anecdotes from summer of daily minyanim, but it was based on 30 years there and trying to capture the sensibility of the place. At MTJ, it's a little bit awkward for me sometimes still not to be more competent than I am. And to
you mentioned the children that would sometimes be hovering around the table and right.
You know, but I think I do get better at it when I work really hard at it, and that's the main thing. And I also talk about the chavrusa process, where sometimes it's good for a more skilled, more experienced scholar to have somebody who's really interested but a little less fluent working with them to test out their chops at actually breaking it down and explaining it to somebody else, right? I use the metaphor of that when I was playing playing tennis, I realized that you always play your best game when you're playing against somebody who's a little bit better than you, because it's a challenge, but you're not completely out of range. But I think in learning one-on-one, the one who's a little bit better gets challenged too, because he can't just try to beat the guy on the other side. He has to work with him. He has to bring him along.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So I think we're going to open it up to some questions, all right? And Deborah, you're going to moderate.
Yes, I have some questions. So a reminder, please, anyone who would like to add questions, please put it in the Q&A box. For those of you, I know there are different versions of Zoom out there, but I think you might find that along the bottom, running there's some tabs along the bottom. There should be a little thing with like two little word bubbles and Q&A. Click on that and you can write your questions there. So yes, let's get started. Okay, the first question, how does the sensation of belonging or not belonging inform the practice of note-taking for you, Jonathan, or field note-taking? And how might the final product of a book as an ethnography of a specific place and time be seen to reflect your comfort or discomfort as both a participant member of the community as an outside researcher of the yeshiva?
Yeah. I see the connection between those two questions, but they are two separate questions. Actually, the first one's a bit easier. First of all, I went into this thinking, this is great because I can spend a year learning. As it happened, and as I explained in the book, I had two semesters of leave, and I had other academic projects that I had promised to work on, and they were basically either done or not too time consuming. So I could devote my time to this and see what happened. And I went in from the beginning thinking, you know, maybe I'll get a book out of this. And if not, I will spend a year learning, which is what traditionally an adult Jew, especially, but by today at least, thank God, not exclusively a male Jew, is supposed to do when he has a lot of free time. And I'd had a taste of it, and I knew I wanted some more. So there would be periods of a couple months when I was diligently taking notes and writing them up every evening, and then 3 or 4 months when I wasn't taking notes, and even when I felt like I should, I didn't know what I should be taking notes about. When I did, that's not awkward in this situation because I'm not the only one in the Beis Medrash who's taking notes, either in the Rosh Hashanah Shiur or when studying together. So it wasn't conspicuous. I'm also not the kind of anthropologist who goes out and hands out surveys or even interviews people. It ends up being very personal because it's about what I saw in the conversations that I had when I was there. Now, the latter question is the tougher one and something that I struggled with for years. I did know from the beginning, even when I was thinking, oh, I might get a book out of this, right? That I didn't want to publish a book that I couldn't bring back into the yeshiva and share with my colleagues there. And I also very much wanted not to write a book that wouldn't meet academic standards. And the standards and values of the secular university do differ in very significant ways with those of a yeshiva like MTJ. So it was when I thought I had that sweet spot or the big enough overlap in the Venn diagram between what I could say in an academic publication and what my colleagues at the yeshiva could read as an acceptable reflection, an account of them, that I started to work on the book. And I'm not going to tell you about all of the things that I left out or all of the negotiations, but I think I left enough in to give a flavor and even some hints of the ways in which some of my values do differ from what I heard from even some of my closest friends there and how I negotiate that.
Great, thank you. There's another question about temporality. This is something you raised earlier, I think it was in one of the first excerpts. Please say more about the temporality of studying Talmud and how that might be thought of as thinking in Jewish or as a kind of Jewish temporality.
Oh, not in the book, but in another piece that I wrote about studying at the yeshiva. I quote, again, Daniel Boyarin, and an early piece by him from the Second Jewish Catalog. I wonder how many of people here know him, the Jewish Catalog. He wrote about Talmud Torah, and he wrote, "Time stops in the world of Talmud Torah. A question asked in the 16th century can be answered in the 11th. And I don't think time quite stops in study, in learning, but it doesn't move forward in the same one direction relentlessly the way it does on the General Motors assembly. And I think one of the great pleasures that people who spend a lot of time in this study derive from it is the sense of connection to ancestors, the sense of being in dialogue with ancestors, sometimes the ability to imagine their world from the way anecdotes are told in the Talmud, and sometimes just, especially with the later commentators, from engaging with their thinking and trying to assess it on our own. These are cross-temporal conversations that I think many other cultures have access to. And I think it reflects something more like what has been the normal human sense of time in most places and in most of history, a sense of the presence of the ancestors. But here it's just in an unusually elaborated and activated and dialectical form.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions here that I think are sort of interrelated, so I'm going to ask them together. One participant asks, how do race, class, and gender influence your experiences navigating the yeshiva or impact the yeshiva culture at large? And the second question is asking about how the book addresses Jewish masculinities and what it can tell us about gender roles and how they are perceived in this specific world.
They're great questions. MTJ is an all-male yeshiva. That's the tradition. If Machon Hadar, frankly, if Machon Hadar, which is a gender egalitarian yeshiva on the Upper West Side, had been on the Lower East Side, I might have wound up there. And if I had written a book, it would have been a very different book. It may be that there's still a certain amount of comfort and camaraderie in a gender separate institution that might be harder to achieve in an egalitarian situation. I'm not sure. As to class, I sure wouldn't say they're not fancy people at MTJ. They're not rich people. I don't know how the place finances itself. Those who do study full time and derive a stipend as Kollel members, it's tiny. I remember once, and I say this in the book, going up to one of the longtime members there and asking him if he had change of a 20, and he looked at me like, yeah, like, I should have change of a 20. I don't, as to race, it's basically an Ashkenazi. If you want to say Ashkenazi is white, say it's an Ashkenazi white yeshiva. And some of the expressions and chit chat I heard around the room when people weren't sitting and studying reflect some of the ethnic tensions, racial tensions, if you want to call them that, that you can imagine, especially in Brooklyn, or that arose out of the redlining and the instability of a neighborhood like the Lower East Side in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But it's a small place, again, with a lot of variety and from one at one scale and at another scale, a great deal of homogeneity. As to gender dynamics among men in the yeshiva, it's a fascinating topic that I might write or speak about in another forum or on another occasion. But it was not a topic really that I felt I could encompass within the scriptures that I had said on myself that I described before.
Thank you. We have a couple of questions also that are asking about navigating the sort of distinction between the kind of learning that takes place at the yeshiva and the kind of learning that takes place at Cornell. So I'm going to ask these questions again back to back because I think the nuance is a little bit different here. But one question is, do you use any of the techniques you have developed in studying the Talmud and teaching your secular students at Cornell, and which ones, and with what results? Mm. And then the other question is, would you, Jonathan, or I think this is also directed at Nathaniel as well, would either of you like to introduce more of the heuristics from the yeshiva learning into your secular schools? And is this happening anywhere? And how would you do this?
Yeah, as to the latter question, I tried to become a teacher who is there at the moment looking to connect with students around whatever text we happen to be studying. And as I said to Nathaniel before, trying to make that moment work and see what we can come up with together. And in that very loose sense, it's a similar spirit. Whenever I can, I actually sneak in a little bit of Talmud study, whether it's a course on Jewish cities, which I would start off with the rules about neighbors being able to carry on the Sabbath within a common courtyard, a compound, and street, to get a sense both of urban architecture for ancient Babylonian Jews and how that affected their social life. Or in a course on modes of Jewish textuality, which I taught a number of years ago, I would spend the first hour of every session studying, I think quite successfully, a chapter from the Tractate Avodah Zarah, which deals with relations between Jews and non-Jews, in the Art School Schottenstein edition, which does a wonderful job of presenting in English gloss a very traditional interpretation of the Talmudic text as a teacher in a yeshiva might give it to you. What's hard in doing that, and I have to keep stressing this over and over again, is I tell students when we do that, the only rule is you must interrupt. If nobody ever interrupts, the thing falls completely flat. And the silver fig leaf, the $64,000 question, is answered when somebody says, wait a second, yesterday the text said so-and-so. And then people say, yeah. Then I say, yeah, that's what learning is, making the text, challenging, engaging with it, not being subservient to it. I think a lot of humanities studies should be.
I would just add one thing to that, which is something that I have tried to do, which is chavrusa, is trying to introduce that into different contexts. And actually, even when I have a chavrusa with a graduate student now, and his area of, well, he actually got his PhD a month ago or so, but anyway, his area of specialization is African-American history, and mine is Jewish history. And we had a chavrusa on Zhuangzi, on this Taoist philosopher, Chinese philosopher, and the Tao Te Ching. And neither one of us, that's not our area. And I said, well, why don't we try this thing? We're both interested in it. Why don't we try this thing called a chavrusa? I explained it to him. And the fact that it wasn't our area of specialization that we were coming to it this way, it's been amazing. And we've been doing it for about 2 years now. And so I really think that the chavrusa is something that can be, sorry, anyway. Good interrupting.
I was going to follow up on that and saying that I similarly actually rolled something out last spring when we went online to try to mitigate some of the distancing of the, you know, the online model, and got my students. I said, you know, this is not monitored, but you need to do this. And I set them up as a chavrusa to study together from wherever they were in whatever modality made sense for them. And it really did, then they felt more confident speaking up in this strange environment.
Yeah, and the thing about the chavrusa, it's not just a one-time thing. It's your chavrusa. It's like it's an ongoing thing. And that's a really key element to it in terms of the relationship and the way in which it works over time. And you find all sorts of really amazing things happening when you do it over time with somebody.
Yeah. Great. There's some questions also about some of the perspectives of the other learners at the yeshiva. So the first has to do with language and language shift. The question is, there's no clearer challenge to the notion of Jewish continuity than language shift from Yiddish to English among Jews on the Lower East Side. Do yeshiva goers ever discuss this topic? And if so, what are their views? And then the other gets to a question, something that you raised earlier about firstness or lastness. Do the people at MTJ consider themselves to be exceptional in the contemporary Jewish world, a form of Jewish learning gradually being replaced by more factionally affiliated learning? Do they see themselves as the last, or do they consider themselves to be in a different relationship to the rest of the Jewish world?
Right. Super questions. The such good questions, especially the second one that that I suspect it was a plant from somebody who's already read the book. So, there is Yiddish. You do hear Yiddish in the Beis Medrash, often from the older men, but the last couple of years there were two or sometimes three young Bratslover Hasidim who came in to study intensively for Smicha, and they're learning in Yiddish, and it's an absolute pleasure to hear it. And it's not only the Hasidim who know Yiddish; some of the more learned middle-aged Litvish, Yeshivish guys speak Yiddish pretty well too, and it seems to be a significant marker, even for those who are not fluent. So Yiddish continues to feed into Yeshivish, and certainly my competence in Yiddish, and some of the terms, some of the idioms, some of the inflections in conversational style were certainly something that helped me to integrate into the Yeshiva much more quickly as well. But I also think that that for some of the fellows a little bit younger than me in the Yeshiva, Yiddish has what Jeff Chandler calls post-vernacular value. It has indexical value. It's not the first language anymore, but it retains value as a mark of authenticity and vibrancy. And what was the second part that I said was so good? You have it?
Yes, give me a second. Okay. If it's coming up in the same order. Nope, it's not. So the other part was, do they see themselves as the last?
Oh yeah. I can't speak for everyone in the Yeshiva, but my dear friend, whom I call Asher Stoller in the book, is someone who had a clear sense that this is a special place. He said to me one time, he said, you know, I used to have the sense that there were all kinds of Jews. There were Bratslover Hasidim, and there were Brisker, and there were people at YU, and they were all holy. You know, the sense that sense has been lost. And then he looked at me and he said, "We're the last ones, man." Now, I make a big deal out of that, because part of what I'm selling in this book is that this is a special place. It's not just pokey. There is something that it's holding on to. But yeah, I do think some of the people there, and people know it's a special place. A story that that a speaker at one of the annual dinners for the MTJ Kollel said once about a fellow from Brooklyn who was looking for a yeshiva, wasn't fitting in anywhere, and somebody said, "Well, you should try MTJ." And came, he spent a little time at MTJ and ended up not going there because it was just too long a commute. But he said, people in Brooklyn said, "Those are real Jews." Yeah, so that is part of what keeps the place going. That is part of the aura of the place.
Great. So you talk about that aura in the way that that it brings people together across some boundaries that are not crossed in other places. But I have some questions here about do those things ever come into conflict? So are there behaviors that get policed? Are there political particular models of respect that clash? And then the other another question that I think is somewhat related is, when you were going between the secular university and the yeshiva world, were you sometimes conscious of boundaries and limitations about what's sayable in the two contexts, about what doubts or questions you could raise or not raise, or had to accept as a starting point?
Yeah. Look, my book before this, my other book about the Lower East Side, is about the Stanton Street Shore, right? Which is a place that in some ways is socially, in terms of religious flavor, whatever that means, a much better fit for me. And the Stanton Street congregation and its rabbi at the time were, for various reasons, a little bit at the margins, a little bit, not just a little bit, they were actually placed on sort of a ban by the other Orthodox rabbis, including our Rosh Yeshiva. So people knew I was involved with Stanton Street, and I would get egged a little bit about that sometimes. And then there are other finer grain distinctions. The one illustration in the book has to do with the question of Kol of Yisrael and whether Orthodox Jews have to eat food only that is made with dairy products that are deemed Kol of Yisrael, being produced by Jews. Rav Moshe Feinstein permitted kosher milk and dairy that was not Kol of Yisrael under certain circumstances. And some people say he didn't, some people say he didn't want people to. Some people said, oh, come on, we went to MPJ and we had OU milk that wasn't Kol of Yisrael every day. Well, people at MTJ remember that Rav Moshe permitted it, but most of the people there at this point only eat Kol of Yisrael. So the one photo I have in the book is of a couple of commercial cakes lying on a table with a note that next to it, written in pencil, that says, this cake is OU, not Kol of Yisrael, enjoy. So, you know, not a big tension, but a marker of shifts and kind of tectonic shifts in the in the complexion of Orthodox communities. Now the tougher question. It's hard to talk about questions of gender and especially gender exclusion when trying to explain to friends in the university why I love this place and why I feel comfortable there. And sometimes when learning, even though when I was talking to Nathaniel before, I stressed ways in which the styles of academic Talmud study and yeshiva Talmud study really do overlap, I was reacting to a text and saying, oh, that probably has a different source. Right, that probably is not part of the same canon, and that's why we see this contradiction. Whereas inside the yeshiva, everything has to be seen as part of the same canon. And it's precisely that requirement that drives so much of the creative work of trying to resolve apparent contradictions between different authorities. So if you come in with the academy's rules, you spoil the game. And I had to be very aware of how the game is played inside leadership in order to be a participant.
So I think that raises a couple of questions here that I think will probably be the last questions for this evening. One is whether the act of your taking notes affected your interaction and in relationships with the fellow learners. And the other was, it has to do with just a question about your studying. And I thought it might be nice to end with you, you know, giving a little bit more of a sort of a qualitative description of your experience studying there, or a few, you know, last words about what it was like for you to study there.
Yeah. I think that taking notes, I think, is not really obtrusive. First of all, because I bring in a tiny notebook, and I get pretty good at writing small, and other people might be writing as well, or writing just a few words as to jog my memory for later. But also because at least some of the people I was studying with know what an anthropologist is. They know I'd written books before. They knew I might be writing one. They knew I'd published an article about MTJ before. I brought it in and shared it with some people. My friend Asher occasionally would say, "Hey, that's one for the notebook." You know, and there are people in the yeshiva who really have wanted this book to come in. And it drives me crazy that right now, because of this damn COVID, I can't go and bring in a stack of them into the yeshiva. And I hope to do that one day. I'm gonna end on a somewhat grandiose note, Deborah, and say that for whatever reason, I am romanticizing, because yes, I'm not always present. Sometimes I tune out. Sometimes it's boring. Sometimes I don't feel good. Sometimes I get impatient. But there are so many moments when studying with people who became really good friends at the yeshiva, studying difficult and sometimes abstruse texts from centuries and centuries ago, where you feel like you're in conversation with the people who are with you in the table, but also the people in the middle column and the people in the marginal columns. And there's such an overcoming of that sense of immense loss, that after all, shadows the consciousness of almost all of us who are so deeply involved in Jewishness in the 21st century, that I said, now I understand why they say that if you're really good in this life, this is what you get to do in the world to come.
So wonderful note to end.
You brought it home there. You brought it home, Jonathan.
Along the sort of more mundane, before I say goodnight, I've been putting in the chat a code that should have come when you registered for the event. But just a reminder, if this has sparked your interest in reading the book and you would like to purchase a print copy, you could go to the Princeton University Press website, and until the middle of November, there's a 30% discount. I keep putting that in the chat, but it's CUJD-FG. I have it written down if you didn't catch that. And you're welcome to email us, and we'll be happy to share that with you if you didn't get it in any of the other prior correspondence. Jonathan, thank you very, very much for sharing this book with us. It's been really a pleasure.
Deborah, is it possible to save the Q&A?
I hope so.
Okay.
I'll do what I can.
Because I see, I'm just peeking now, and I see some great questions, including from people I haven't spoken to for years, and value, and I'll be happy to try to answer.
Okay.
Great.
Jonathan, thank you for sharing your book.
And I'm so grateful to everybody for coming tonight.
Yes, and thank you, Nathaniel, for joining us, and for having such a great discussion. And thanks to all of you for joining us this evening.
Or if I didn't get to answer your question, email me, jboyarin@cornell.edu. Love to hear from you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Good night.